Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Sophia Kolmainen. She's the program director for the Council for Responsible Genetics. And we're meeting at a conference today on research ethics at Trinity College. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And I wanted to hear more about what the Council's work is. I have been a member at various points and follow the work of the Council. And I want to hear a little bit about its history. So could you tell us about its origins?
Sure. We are a national nonprofit organization, but we are based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the group began really in the late 70s around recombinant DNA technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there were huge debates about that then. And a group of people who ranged from scientists, academics, religious people, a couple lawyers, and some activists got together and just said, there's things that are going on in science that we need to be discussing, that there need to be more forums for public debate, and they started CRG. And it was incorporated in 1983, and we've been publishing a bi-monthly newsletter since then, Gene Watch.
And what was the scope of the concerns of CRG in the 80s?
We've always been very broad. The mission of the organization is to increase public debate about the introduction of new genetic technologies. And within that mission, we say we will raise social, ethical, environmental implications. So we've covered everything from genetically engineered food through human cloning and other health implications of genetic technologies. We started in the 80s, early 80s, around biowarfare and biological weapons. And our big campaign in the early 80s was getting scientists to sign on to a pledge that said that they wouldn't want their research used for biological weapons and biological warfare, which is timely now. That, I mean, that was something that we spent a lot of time on and had a pledge with hundreds of people who signed on within the scientific community. And that was maybe 80 through 85, 86, that really was going. And
do you intervene directly in legislative debates?
We do. Legislation is one place that you can really make a difference as a small organization, because you can, if you can neatly conceptualize what you want and what's important, you can go and talk to someone on a one-on-one basis. So we do use that technique going into state and federal legislatures and talking to them about our issues and trying to get those incorporated into bills and other things that are being passed.
Must have been pretty lonely back in the 80s, but in the 90s there's been a growth of many different organizations addressing these topics.
Yeah, definitely. In the 80s, I think we were seen as a very, very fringe organization, and we were talking about things like human cloning, and people were pretty much saying, it's not important, it's not something that affects us right now, and we're not all that interested in it. And now there's groups that are forming. It's really become an issue where last year, a scientist said he's going to clone someone within a year. So the environment around the technology has really changed.
Mm-hmm. The Chinese just announced that they had cloned their first, for the purpose of culling stem cells, cloned their first human embryo.
Yeah, and you know, there's even things going on closer that continue to push the line in human genetic technologies. In the fall, a company in Massachusetts announced that they had paid people for the production of embryos solely for research. So that was a real step that hadn't taken place before.
Advanced Cell Technologies is just, an hour drive away from your office. So yep. Do you have any frothy interactions with them?
Yeah, they're definitely someone who we keep an eye on. but we're not one of the they actually get protested, and there's a lot of, negative feeling in the community, because they really are an example of what's going on as far as they're plunging ahead in a field that isn't highly regulated without a whole lot of public debate. So they achieve something and then they announce it, which is really the pattern in genetic technologies and what we would hope.
As opposed to peer review publication.
Yeah, well, we would hope for more discussion, especially because genetic technologies are different from something like, a chemical experiment in a lab. our opinion is that genetic technologies are so transformative and make a difference in so many people's lives that they require everyone saying beforehand whether or not they think that use is a good idea. So what we would have hoped...
Everyone?
Well, the broadest spectrum possible. So,
but you don't expect a consensus of society.
No, and that's the tricky thing on this issue, is that almost none of these questions have answers that you can say your answer is right and your answer is wrong. They're all gray issues, which, again, stresses why they need to be discussed and debated in public. Something like ACT, what we would have hoped for would be an announcement of here's something that we're thinking about doing, and then having a public discussion about whether or not that's something that we want. Is that a worthwhile technology? What are the risks? What are the costs? Mm-hmm. And having a full debate about it.
You've adopted a series, CRG has adopted a series of position statements over the last 10 years or so. And apparently, most recently, you adopted a position on therapeutic cloning, which mm-hmm. is relatively controversial given, your position against genetically engineered food is relatively well accepted mm-hmm. in environmental circles. But tell us a little bit about the debate around the therapeutic cloning.
Therapeutic cloning was definitely a difficult issue for us as an organization to deal with, and I think for people in general. And mostly, the difficulty there is because the debate in the public has been set up as pro-life, or you're a scientist and you're supportive of the benefits of this technology. So
you want to keep Christopher Reeves in his wheelchair.
Exactly. You're either working towards progress, science, full steam ahead, or you believe that embryos are people. And that makes it it's a very controversial issue just to discuss, let alone to try and discuss the intimate details of it and try and figure out what actually is a responsible position in that area. CRG is a pro-choice organization, and we took our position against therapeutic cloning, stating that right up front, that we're pro-choice, and we do have some questions that we raise about the health issues related to egg donation, and that is the reason that we have taken a position against therapeutic cloning.
The safety and the trials and travails of being an egg donor, procuring eggs, that's what you're concerned about?
Yeah, definitely. And there it's mostly around the drugs that are used, the hormones, and there just hasn't been a lot of safety testing, mostly because a lot of safety testing hasn't been demanded by the public. And so if you don't know that's an issue, then you're not questioning it, and there's no debate. So
10 years, 5 years down the road, if there were accumulated evidence that egg procurement is not a seriously dangerous thing for a woman, then it would be okay?
I would say if we can assure that there aren't health risks to women, that yes, we probably wouldn't have a problem with experiments on embryos.
Now, is that true across the board for the kinds of concerns that you have? Are there principally safety, efficacy concerns, safety for the environment, safety for human beings? Or do you also have a kind of a more global critique of, as many environmental organizations do, that there is a line beyond which humanity should not cross in the intervention into natural processes?
I would say that we've defined a more global line, though we do raise health and safety issues across the board in the technologies that we look at. We also consider how these technologies affect society and culture as a whole. And in human genetic technologies, you'll see in things like germline manipulation and even things that are taken for granted, like prenatal testing, we continue to raise questions there about what kind of information's been given, what kind of choices are being made, who's making the decisions about those tests, and what's being offered, and what's being labeled a disease and not. So there's a whole range of issues. And there are lines that we've drawn that we say shouldn't be crossed. For example, we say that cloning shouldn't be used for human reproductive purposes, and that though we raise safety concerns, even if it were 100% safe, we wouldn't support it as a reproductive technology.
Because?
we look at human cloning as something, it's actually a very good example of what's going on in the genetic field, in that it's a highly invasive, highly technological, very expensive technology, which we don't really feel is necessary. It's dealing with a social problem in that it looks at people who want to have genetically related children, and it's not something that actually creates a benefit as a whole to society.
Don't those complaints apply to IVF as well, though?
Well, they do, and some of those same issues arise in IVF, and that's why, though we don't have a stand against IVF, and I think that's something that you would never get in this culture because IVF has had so many so-called successes in that...
In vitro fertilization, test tube babies.
Yeah, test tube babies. I mean, there's so many people who really do want to have a genetically engineered child who are able to go to IVF if they can afford it. And have a child through IVF, you're not going to see that technology withdrawn at this point, even though, you know, there are risks.
So you would be opposed to it, but it's just pragmatically you don't think it can be stopped.
Well, I don't think that we would be opposed to it as much as our broader issues about how technology is introduced and used. Those same issues come up in IVF. It's something that the government has stepped away from regulating and is being offered by a very lucrative market-driven industry. And from that sort of perspective, you need to be wary of the information that you're getting and the drugs that you're being asked to take and the way that they report their results. All of those things are influenced by the fact that it's a billion-dollar industry. So, we're not opposed to it, but we're saying there's room there for more discussion and more information to be given out to people who decide that that's something they want to pursue.
I mean, I think it's perfectly obvious that they need more regulation when you see the number of multiple births, which is, for me, the most immoral thing that is produced by fertility clinics, where they they endanger the lives of these kids and they create this pronatalist environment where parents think that they're heroes for raising a family of six septuplets or whatever.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. And, the health effects on those children are, immeasurable. It's the more children you have in the womb, everyone knows, it's a fact that that produces health effects later on. And, that's a very big, undeniable problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also taken a position against the patenting of the human genome and genomes in general. This is something I'm totally down with. The patenting issue really foresees a future where we don't have access to the fruits of these new technologies.
Mm-hmm. The patenting issue is very complicated because the patenting system is really embedded in how the United States does business. There's a basis for it in the Constitution that someone who invents an idea can have the right to stop other people from recreating that idea to their economical advantage. And so the inventor is given special rights from which he can stop other people from building his idea and charge them money to use it. And though that's worked relatively well in mechanical sciences and, there's patents on things, everything from like a coffee table to a fan, the situation is very different when you look at it as patents on life and on parts of life.
But explain this to me. I guess I can understand why you would be able to argue if you created a genetically engineered mouse that had a new genetic structure of some kind, why you'd be able to argue that you should have a patent on that. But patenting the discovery of the genome itself, this has always boggled my mind. It seems like this is like you map out a territory and you try to publish the map. Yeah, you can have a copyright on your map, but you can't claim that you're king of the country. Right. And that's what they're trying to do.
Well, it's a very strange situation because the patent office has laid down several requirements that you need in order to get a patent, and they've really stretched those requirements when it comes to patents on life, and precisely for the reason that you said that the number one requirement for having a patent is that it needs to be novel or new, and it's very hard to justify a novel or new patent on something that has existed for billions and billions of years. So they've done that. There was a court case that sort of broke the water where a scientist got a patent on a bacteria that ate oil spills, or products from oil spills. And that really sort of opened the floodgates to life patents on mammals, on gene sequences, and segments of DNA. So,
well, the patent office has taken a lot of hits over this policy, and they've become a little bit more restrictive over the last year or two.
A little bit. They did just change the utility requirements of their patent guidelines, but still, for the biotech industry, the patent is how they make their money. If you are doing research as a biotech company on a product that could be patented, that sort of bait is how you get investors to give you large amounts of money, because it secures you a monopoly for the next 20 years. So it's something that we're opposed to and that we're fighting against, but it's a very large battle that we were at.
If we were to outlaw patents on the human genome, do you think that patenting the applications, the techniques for exploiting the human genome, you know, for instance, the therapies, the therapeutic interventions, wouldn't that provide sufficient profit to still be a spur to innovation in this industry?
Yep, that's actually one of the very good proposals that's up right now, is sort of an alternative to the old patent system. And it does. It creates a good balance between allowing people the most access possible to beneficial technologies that come out of our own human genetic code, and also allowing companies to recoup some of the investment that they need in order to research the benefits of the technology. So it's a good balance.
You had an interest in feminism that brought you to this, one of the topics. You were also an environmental law background person. There is, of course, a huge feminist critique of reproductive technology and genetics, but there are also some feminists, and there's one here at our conference this weekend, who has argued that reproductive technology promises liberation of women from the dictates of biology. Do you ever feel that qualm, that in fact it may be that modern technology is that feminism is reifying the natural in a way that is in fact regressive, and that technology itself may be a progressive and liberatory force?
I would say my main issue is that you need to think about what it means to have a choice. And so if a company or even a person is offering you a choice, that choice needs to be meaningful for it to actually bring you any benefit. And in the field of reproductive technologies, we're seeing a lot of companies right now offering women choices, really so-called choices, designed to make women feel empowered within the reproductive rights sphere. And there's actually a lot of reasons to think that those choices aren't actually empowering women. And that comes out of looking at where do those choices come from. So what kind of information is a woman being given before she makes that choice? And what kind of options does she have to her in the context of making that choice? And in things like prenatal testing and pre-implantation diagnosis, there are good arguments that can be made that you're not actually being given a choice in that situation, mostly because the information that you have available to you and your financial resources don't put you on par with the person who's giving you that information.
That seems like a problem principally of poor informed consent, which is something that could be fixed by having better informed consent as opposed to regulating the technology itself.
Well, I think that's definitely part of it. I would want to see better informed consent as the central part of, if you really want to give women power in the reproductive rights sphere, that power needs to be meaningful, and that can be achieved through informed consent, looking at the definition of informed consent. But it goes beyond that in that the choices that are being offered themselves change the environment and sort of the context of reproductive rights, so that, say, a clinic is offering pre-implantation diagnosis of embryos for a disease, a debilitating disease, let's say, as an example. That seems like something that a parental couple would want to know about before they give birth. Even if they're a couple that's very anti-abortion, there's things that you could do right off the bat when the baby's born if you know that it's going to have a debilitating disease that's going to get it within the first couple days. So that would be a choice that would be empowering. However, when you look at that down the range of things that could be available as the genome is mapped and we link certain genetic patterns to traits, you're opening up a debate that's not just one person's view of what is a debilitating disease or not. It opens up the whole range from what is disease to what is healthy to what is better than healthy, what is enhancement, and what will make your child even better, though maybe not necessarily
But don't we always make those trade-offs? I mean, as a parent, I have the choice to send my kids to a variety of different private school options, to spend different amounts of money on different kinds of health care, different kinds of food, different kinds of clothing, private tutoring.
Exactly.
And so, you know, in the future, if parents have the you know, if parents put a high, very high premium, they had a bad experience, they had a mentally disabled sibling, and they definitely don't want to raise a mentally disabled child, and they put a high premium on that, why shouldn't they have access to that kind of choice?
Well, that's exactly the issue that we're talking about, is that these technologies that are being sold as something that is a medical benefit aren't really necessarily a medical benefit. They are more like, do you want your child to go to private school or do you not want your child to go to private school? And there are even sort of more transformative than that, because we're dealing with a child at the embryo stage where we're making changes within their genetic makeup that we cannot totally predict. Even in the future when we get better at it, we cannot predict how those are going to play out.
But reproduction is a crapshoot all by itself. So,
yeah.
So isn't it better to have some kind of control rather than just roll the dice?
That's definitely an argument that people are saying, but it's not something that can really be persuasive, because you're looking at a third party coming in and interfering in a way that is presented, and it goes back to the informed consent, which really is my main issue with the technology. But it's presented as the potential to make the baby better, and it's given, and you'll see this in advertisements all the time. It's a large assumption made on something that isn't as uncomplicated as they'll make it seem. So they'll say, we know that this certain genetic grouping will lead, you know, people who are more intelligent have this sort of genetic grouping. And so we could insert that and maybe your child will be more intelligent. And that raises a whole host of issues beyond the ethical issues of, you know, messing with your child, and but even beyond that, in the third person interfering with the structure of the cell, and what do you really know about inserting those genes and how those genes are going to interact with each other and interact
needs
with
a lot of testing. Needs a lot of guarantees.
Beyond that, what it needs is a lot of discussion, because your neighbor doing that is going to affect the world that you live in.
I've been speaking with Sophia Colmain, and she's the program director for the Council for Responsible Genetics. And you can find out more about the activities of the council at
www.gene-watch.org.
And can people email you?
Yep, they can email at us at crg@gene-watch.org.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Human dignity. It sounds nice, but I've become allergic to it. Like love and God, I've decided that it's an empty signifier, a bit of verbal hand-waving deployed when people don't really know what they're trying to protect or assert. Why am I bothered by this? Well, because it's become a useful quasi-religious phrase for crypto-Christians who want to tell us what to do. Legal prostitution, legalized drugs, legalized cloning, or genetic engineering are unthinkable because these things allegedly violate, quote, human dignity. Since human dignity is such an empty but commonly used phrase, the empty dignifiers never need to get around to telling us exactly how X violates dignity. Of course, human dignity is also used by progressives who want to uplift the poor and the oppressed,
and who want people treated as ends in themselves rather than as means to others' ends. For instance, human dignity is in the preamble and Article 1 of my favorite manifesto, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Quote, "Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world, and the peoples of the United Nations have in this charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights and in the dignity and worth of the human person and in the equal rights of men and women and have determined to promote social progress and better standards of life and larger freedom." And then again in Article 1, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights." Of course, I'll salute the tactical use of any language if it serves the cause of liberty and equality. But the reason I'm against oppression and for liberty and equality is because I want to build a happier society, one that eliminates unnecessary suffering. The growing neo-puritanical use of dignity seems to imply that the suffering that results from the war on drugs or the war on genetic research are secondary to promoting dignity. For instance, listen to the use of dignity by Leon Cass, the reactionary bioethicist appointed by President-elect Bush to chair the President's Council on Bioethics and put as many roadblocks in the path to medical progress as possible. Cass writes, quote, "Our task really is to find a way to reap the benefits of medical science without undermining human dignity or human decency. We want to bequeath to our children a world in which human dignity, no less than human health, can flourish." So how exactly will it increase anybody's dignity if we consign millions to remain in their wheelchairs or their nursing homes by banning the use of cloned embryos to develop therapies for spinal and brain diseases? What Cass really means is that medicine must recognize the immortal soul of the embryo. Dignity becomes a vague reference to our divinely created nature, and therefore anything that Christians think is bad for that soul, such as drugs, sex, rock music, and embryo cloning, they're all ipso facto violations of human dignity. Think of the Iranian Office for the Propagation of Virtue and the Suppression of Vice. Sounds like a great idea, except that it basically means other people telling you what to read, write, do, eat, sleep with, in order to protect your and everybody else's virtue and dignity. What are we really trying to say with human dignity? Dignity means inherent nobility and worth, and the respect and honor associated with an important position. So dignity means that we want to treat every person with the respect that we used to reserve for nobility. We want every individual to have the freedoms of nobles, rather than the constraints of serfs and peasants. Looked at this way, the inherent worth and dignity of every person means we are committed to being treated as the equal of even the nobility, and having full individual liberty, freedom to control one's own person and affairs, freedom from arbitrary and oppressive authority. In short, human dignity may be useful for forging vague agreements within religious organizations and international bodies that range from progressives to conservatives and from secular to the religious. But it's not much of a guide to action, and seems to me to have been increasingly subverted as a phrase. The alternative is to affirm what we really mean by dignity, which is what was meant by its original revolutionary French and American champions, that we are for liberty and equality. So the next time someone starts throwing around human dignity, put liberty and equality in its place and see if what they are saying still makes any sense. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J., email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.